Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, everybody. We're going to take public testimony on the governor's budget recommendations, and I guess I should say on the budget in general recommendations today. And any comments related to the budget are welcome today from the public and organizations. And then we will be getting some detailed, hopefully a detailed update on what's going on with the Renewable Development Fund. So let's start. We have Eric Jolly, I think, first. And are you ready to go, Dr. Jolly? Welcome to the committee. We're sorry we have to bring you here, but it was kind of nice to see you in the governor's budget untouched, but we think it was probably an accident. I hate to say that.
Well,
maybe I'm wrong.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. Joining me today is Brenda Rainey, who works in our government affairs and liaison work. And I hope this was the one inspired moment of the governor's budgeting that we are experiencing. That's how I slept well at night, is in that belief. Before I came here, as I got the call last night that we'd have this chance, and I thank you so much for the opportunity to address the committee, I was thinking of how I wanted to start, and it occurred to me, I have a friend, an American Indian elder, who spends a lot of time thinking, and every once in a while he'll call me up, and I'll never know what he's going to say, but he'll say, you know, Eric, I've been thinking lately, and I'll brace myself. And I said, and what have you been thinking about? And the last call, he said, I've been thinking about a word. Courage, he said. And as I think about that word, it occurred to me that courage is really a very simple thing. It's not an easy thing, but it isn't a complex thing. Courage, he said, is the ability to make a decision and take responsibility for it. And I've thought long and hard about that definition. And while courage may be many things, that definition seems very powerful to me. That decision can be life-changing. It can have consequences for others. But real courage is making a decision and taking responsibility for it. I thought about that because I thought I wanted to tell you how happy I am to sit here and have you sitting there. The courage that it takes to hold your position is remarkable. And I admire what you're doing and that you're considering decisions that may not be equitable for all, that aren't easy for anyone, and that aren't simple as decisions, and that you do that with courage. With that being said, I look at this very difficult budget situation and can tell you today that the Science Museum wants to be a part of the solution and not a part of your problems. And we're going to work very hard to do that. We think we're a part of the solution for the state in the long term as we look at the Department of Economic Development of the United States saying, and the Department of Commerce, 3 out of 5 new jobs that will be created over the next decade that pay more than minimum wage are going to be in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And laying out a foundation for that educational success for our students is a foundation for our future success. When we know that sector of our economy grew 4 times faster than the rest of the economy in the last decade, even with the current recession, we know the hopes for our recovery are going to be in the sector that the Science Museum talks to, recruits, and works with. We know that when we look at the health of our community, it's the Science Museum's work through the St. Croix Watershed Research Station that helps us create a healthier environment on all the rivers and that helps prepare for that future that we want for our state. And so I want to talk about how we can be a part of the solution and also how I think we are. But I had truly 3 simple points that I wanted to make as I thought about the difficult task that you face. The first one is I'm proud of all the ways in which Minnesota leads the nation. We're number 1 or 2 in science and math education. We jockey and elbow Massachusetts back and forth this year, becoming number 2, next year becoming number 1 again. I'm proud of the environment, care that we have, the health of our people, But I'm not proud of some of the other things that I hope we aspire to improve on. It saddens me that Minnesota is 46th in the nation, according to the Center for American Progress, 46th in the nation in the availability of out-of-school and after-school programs for our students and their families. 46th. We're 42nd in the nation in utilization of out-of-school and after-school programs, which sadly means we're already overtaxing those very few precious resources that we already have. And while I'm proud that we're number one or two in science and math achievement, it troubles me that we are at the bottom in terms of closing the achievement gap between minority and non-minority students, with the largest gap in the nation. And so we have some things we need to improve, and I hope that's where we will focus our resources. Second thing that I would like to speak to is that just about 3% of funding that the state gives to our museum is an essential 3%. It is what we live off of after the first round of cuts that we put into the core of supporting the Science Museum of Minnesota. And when I say core, what I'm talking about is cleaning windows, vacuuming rugs, creating a respectful place for our visitor, for the teachers, for the programs that we operate. I can't get a donor to pay for cleaning windows. I've never seen one that said windows cleaned by Cargill. We haven't mastered that roadside program that the Department of Transportation has. And so we use that core money as foundation for our investing in the rest of the state. Because of that core, for example, we were able to go to Cargill Corporation and raise more than $2 million for the Minneapolis and Hopkins school districts, creating the first in the nation's district-wide implementation of an engineering curriculum in third, fourth, and fifth grade. That's almost $2.5 million brought into the school system because we had the foundational core to help raise money for them. It's how we managed to serve over 77 counties and their schools on site every year, not with money from the state, but with clean carpets from the state. It's how we serve 21 school districts so intensively that they are among 9 out of the 10 most advanced districts in advancing math and science achievement. In fact, in District 196, the two most improved districts in the last year attribute their program advancement to their work with the Science Museum of Minnesota, not paid for by the state, but by 3M and General Mills, because we have a building with clean windows that they're willing to fund great programs to be in. And so that core money is more than leveraged. It is essential to these programs. And if this core shrinks, so do the programs. It's a matter I can't help. And so my third point is understanding, I hope, better the reach of the Science Museum. Many of you know this is a great place to bring your families, over 1 million visitors a year. You may know that we're the most highly funded museum in America from the National Science Foundation, earning more money than the combined totals of the Smithsonian. That's all wonderful that we can help bring that into our economy, that we do more teacher professional development than any other institutions in the state, and that we're nationally recognized for our service, winning the Gulf Guardian Award from the Environmental Protection Agency as the agency that contributed more to the health and well-being of the Gulf of Mexico here in Minnesota. So you may know that reach. But many people don't realize that when you try and separate out parts of the Science Museum, it's like pulling apart a bowl full of spaghetti. Pieces stick together because we're a part of the fabric of this state and this region. This year, 52,000 individuals and families were able to take advantage of our Great Ticks program, attending the museum for as little as a dollar. That's a fun statistic. But did you know that how we do that? We distribute that money through 100 United Way agencies. No one has to come into the Science Museum and go to our ticket counter and say, here's proof I'm poor. 100 United Way agencies rely on the Science Museum of Minnesota to provide them with the means to serve their clients in family programming, in out-of-school programming, in after-school programming, in informal and formal learning. And if we cut the Science Museum of Minnesota, we're cutting the budget and programming capacity of 100 United Way agencies. We're cutting our ability to support 21 districts. So we're cutting our programming for teachers. We're cutting our programs for students. We're cutting our after-school and out-of-school programming. We're not cutting our clean windows, but because we'll have to find other resources, we'll have fewer venues to provide that. And so as we look at what it means to fund a science museum, about 3% of our budget, it is the most critical 3% because it is out of that that we build a $40 million a year service institution. We've just created a new seed, bringing libraries online, helping them to extend their relevancy. We've opened in 2 satellite libraries now, and we have plans to go statewide. And so as we look at what will happen when we cut the Science Museum, we're looking at cutting the programming of libraries, cutting the programming of United Way agencies, cutting the programmings of schools, cutting the programming of teacher support organizations, and even 19 independent schools. And I am sorry that I haven't figured out how to help us do this without state support, because I would not want to be in the position of having to evaluate where we provide cuts. I do hope we'll be a part of the solution. We know we may have to share the pain, but I do believe that the brightest moment in the governor's budget was leaving the Science Museum alone in the second round of cuts, because we stood tall to take the first round and still added to our support of the state. I want to thank you for inviting me here, for doing a job which I would not want to do, and allowing me to do this magnificent job that I take so much joy in doing. Science is an essential literacy. It is our way out for the future. It is where this state is going to grow. We're going to help lead it. And if we have to lead at a slower pace, we will. But if you can let us go at the speed we are now, I think our recovery will come faster. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators, for your attention. I'll be very happy to take questions.
Dr. Jolly, thank you so much. I know you're all about, your museum's all about teaching and inspiring, and your comments always teach and inspire us, so thank you. And I think you really make the point well that we need to be careful as we cut. You know, there's a line between, tightening our belts and focusing on priorities and being more efficient and going down that road of eating our seed corn. And I think that's what you're talking about, that the investments that we make and all those people in Minnesota that you reach, all those children that you reach, is all about the investment in our future. And I appreciate that message very much and the good work that you do. Can you tell us, but did you get some support from legacy funds? I've heard you did. And what was that program? Is that a new program that you've funded with legacy funds?
Madam Chair, Senators, yes. We received a modest amount of legacy dollars, which we're using for very prescribed reasons. None of the material support that I've talked about here today are related to the legacy dollars. We're using our legacy dollars in 2 clear areas. One is the acquisition and maintenance of Minnesota's historic treasures. Namely, we have just acquired major parts of the Bishop Whipple collection, one of the most valued American Indian artifact collections that had been threatening to leave the state of Minnesota. And so we've fought and used our dollars and used our staff time matching those dollars to preserve Minnesota's cultural history and legacy. and we're very committed to that. The other portion of that money, a very small portion, is creating the capacity to do statewide teleconferencing for our in-schools so that schools in greater Minnesota can have access to the Whipple collection and other parts of the cultural legacy that we're attempting to preserve with those dollars. We appreciate those dollars. They're not allowed to augment any of the core operating support or other programs, and we simply want to invest them wisely for the state and for its cultural heritage.
You don't clean windows with those.
No, I'm sorry that we cannot clean windows with
those.
That's
good. We don't want you to clean windows with those, so that's important. Are there other questions? All right. I think we understand, I guess, what the choices are. So thank you so much for being here, and we appreciate your testimony today.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you so much for your time and attention, and thank you for having made that wonderful institution what it is. Please visit us often. We'll make you proud. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks. All right, next, I think we may have a group coming up. Steve Morris, Cheryl Appledore, and Paul Austin. Welcome to the committee. Senator Morse.
Thank you very much. Yes, the three of us are going to kind of work together here and do it as one panel, you indicated. So let me introduce myself. I'm Steve Morse. I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Environmental Partnership. I think most of you are familiar with our organization, but it is a coalition of more than 80 environmental conservation groups representing nearly a half a million Minnesotans in a combined membership. And we appreciate having the opportunity to talk here a little bit today. This is a very important issue you have before us, before you. And so we greatly understand the difficulty that you're facing this year, this session, in these times. And so we appreciate you listening and appreciate you taking this challenge on. My comments today are going to focus primarily on the keeping the integrity of the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Constitutional Amendment. With the passage of this amendment, the amendment is really inextricably intertwined with the budgeting that we do in environmental and conservation programs over the next couple of decades plus. And it's important for us to remember, even in these really tough, difficult economic times, that we must be true to the 1.6 million voters, the 60% of the people who voted on this question who amended the Constitution last year to provide more money for environment and natural resources, our lakes, rivers, and streams, if you will. And politically speaking, November of 2008 is a long time ago. And it's easy to kind of start to forget about that sentiment that was expressed so clearly at that time. And I know the people on this committee understand it and understand the message that was given. But I just want to let folks know that we do scientifically based surveying every fall. And just before Thanksgiving, the week of November, or the period between November 11th and 15th, we pulled statewide 605 randomly selected Minnesota voters.
2009.
Excuse me. Did I say five?
You didn't say what year.
2009.
I thought that's what you meant.
2009, yes, this past November. And we asked people, you know, because we saw the session that was shaping up, and we asked them, in these tough economic times, elected officials must be reminded that we want to protect Minnesota's great outdoors for the long term. We must not let elected officials raid constitutionally dedicated conservation programs to solve short-term budget problems. We laid that as an option and said, do you agree with that? Or do you more agree with, and these are, you know, fairly strong statements, but we wanted to get a sense of where people were at. Or do you believe this is more in line with your thinking? Given the state's current budget crisis, it is appropriate for state legislators to use money from this amendment to prevent cuts to existing programs to protect land and water. And the outcomes of that was 70-21. Overwhelmingly, the public gets the fact that what we did is we passed an amendment to protect what we have and do more. And that's really the essence of the message that I want to bring to you today. And I know you've heard it before, but I particularly want to comment on how it fits with the governor's budget. And I do have a letter that some of you have seen, if we could maybe get distributed. But just about 2 months ago, MEP joined with 30 other member groups and other conservation, hunting, and fishing groups from around the state, many of whom were deeply involved in the amendment, and submitted a letter to legislative leadership that reiterated the principles that we collectively adopted last year to judge and monitor how We collectively, the state is doing in keeping the faith of the public and monitoring the use of the amendment dollars. And we developed three principles. And this is what we're using for review and monitoring how we're doing going forward. And I just want to touch on those three principles and comment on how we see them fitting with the governor's budget that you are now considering. Principle number one was Minnesota's Great Outdoors must maintain its share of the total state general fund budget and not dip below its proportion for the 2008-2009 biennium, which was a 30-year low. Any general fund cuts proposed for environmental and conservation programs must not result in a percentage reduction in these programs that is greater than any percentage reduction in total general fund spending. Now, you've heard that before, I think, and that was really what the legislature followed last year and did a great job of following that thinking last year and made proportional cuts even though it was a cutting year, a reduction year. In 2008-2009, about 1.1% of the general fund went to environmental conservation programs. And the general fund reductions that you're considering this biennium from the governor seem to be roughly in line with that. What we've done is we've said we must set a threshold that at no time should our general fund allocation for these programs go below the 1% level. That's kind of the benchmark, if you will. Understanding it's going to vary a little bit. That leaves a little room for variance. But we, if you go below the 1%, we think it's passing a really important benchmark threshold. And basically, we have to sound the alarm and say we think it's not in sync with the voters' wishes. Unfortunately, based on the budget forecast, the long-term effect of the cuts proposed to date by the governor will drop that percentage below this 1% threshold in the out years. That's because of the way the cuts are occurring this year, partially through the biennium, as I understand it, and then the change potentially in the base next year as education shifts, or in the next biennium, if education shifts back and the base number changes. So this concerns us greatly. We ask that the legislature uphold the will of the public and not let the allocation of state funds for environmental and conservation programs drop below this benchmark of 1% of general fund allocations in the current budget, which we seem to be somewhat on track for, or in the planning budget for the next biennium, as the governor proposes. The second principle, also laid out in our letter, is a little bit more simple. It basically says statutorily dedicated funds already in existence for Minnesota's Great Outdoors cannot be raided to pay for other budget items. Now, remember back to the constitutional amendment that was adopted? These funds are to supplement what we're currently doing. So what we're doing now, just like the poll said, and then do more. And so one of our principles last year was no raiding of dedicated funds. What I can say is that the governor's budget really misses the boat on this principle. In 2003, when we had a major budget crisis, the first year of the Plenty administration, we saw major raids on our dedicated funds. Last year, when we again were facing some severe budget issues, presumably, at least in part, in response to the strong public will that was expressed in the legacy amendment, we did not see these raids against the statutory funds. This year's budget, however, harkens back to the old strategy of using dedicated funds, including fees paid by boaters. I'm just about ready to renew my canoe registration, and out across from my place in Dakota, we have a water access that is so rutted you can't drive it down it anymore. The fence is falling apart. Very poor disrepair. There's some money in the boating access fund. The governor's budget proposes that we take that money and put it in the general fund instead of using my few dollars and how many million people are boat holders here in Minnesota, the highest number in the nation. So these fees that are paid by boaters, park users, fees collected to fund recycling, these funds are being taken to support general state budget purposes that for which it was never intended. To state it very simply and clearly, this constitutes a raid that is inconsistent with the provisions of the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. It is not in keeping with the intent or will of the public, and we believe it violates the plain language of the Constitution. We hope that you'll look very seriously at these raids and not let them go forward. My colleague Cheryl Appledorn from Conservation Minnesota will go into more of the numbers on the dedicated funds. and we can have some more discussion about it. In addition, Paul Austin will be talking about one particular program of inflow and infiltration and how we don't think that is a good use of these dedicated funds. But before that, I want to briefly touch on the third principle, which is really where we started the discussion with the letter 2 months ago, and that is relative to bonding. We've Conservation Minnesota, in particular, and you'll hear from Cheryl in a minute, has done an analysis of budget allocation for conservation and environmental purposes for over the last 8 years. And we've got a defined set of programs that we look at, and we've done an analysis, or they've done an analysis that we use, that indicates that over the past 10 years, an average of 22.2% of our state bonding dollars have been allocated to conservation environmental resource programs. That's the traditional level of support of bonding here in the state of Minnesota. And we've asked people to maintain that level, at least, in their bonding bills. I'm very happy to say that the governor's budget met that test, the Senate's bill met that test, the House's bill met that test, even with the additions late in the process, and the conference committee report that was passed earlier has met that test. Congratulations. Thank you. We appreciate that you're keeping the trust in this way, and we hope that as that bill gets modified, as it's likely to do, you'll continue to keep that trust and make sure that overall this share of the pie does not shrink. With that, let me just say thank you for your time. I'm going to turn it over to Cheryl Appledorn from Conservation Minnesota, and maybe the three of us can do our comments, and then we'd be happy to stand for any questions. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Appledorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Cheryl Appledorn. I'm with Conservation Minnesota. And like Steve Morse just said, I'm here to talk a little bit about the annual analysis of the governor's budget that we do. We've done this analysis now for 8 years, since 2002. Every year in the February, we take a look at the governor's budget proposals, and then in the fall, we do a wrap-up report as well. We've just now begun to look at the governor's proposals for the current year. And we are still finalizing our report. We hope to have it done by the end of the week. When we look at conservation and environment budgets, focus in on five primary conservation agencies. A little bit different than this committee's jurisdictions, that's important to note. We have always looked at DNR, PCA, Bowser, Metropolitan Parks, and the Department of Agriculture as the primary conservation agencies. So the numbers that I'm talking about relate to those five agencies. This year, as we looked at the governor's budget, as Steve Morris mentioned, really our primary concern was the approach that the governor took in withdrawing funds from statutorily dedicated funds for conservation and transferring them for use in the general fund. If you look at those five primary conservation agencies, the transfer of statutorily dedicated funds comes up to just under $10 million. And I know this committee has looked at these in some detail. You probably are familiar with them. But two of the largest braids that we would really highlight as areas of concern are $2 million that are withdrawn from the Natural Resources Fund, particularly the Water Recreation Account. And the almost $4 million is taken from the Environmental Fund. And these are not primarily unallocated funds or unspent balances. The agencies have indicated, lead to reductions in programs. They'll lead to less work in supporting our canoe and boating routes, our water recreation opportunities, less recycling programs, reductions in e-waste, and environmental assistance. So these are real cuts. And this is exactly the type of erosion of existing funds that we believe the language in the constitutional amendment was designed to prevent. So that is why that's the primary reason we have a concern about that. But there's other reasons in addition to the Constitution that we would highlight, two in particular. One is just the more overriding concept that these funds are understood by citizens and the public to be used for specific purposes. Citizens and others pay charges and license fees and other receipts that they believe will be used for specific purposes. And when those funds are transferred out of these dedicated funds, it's really a breach of faith to the public. And then secondly, and this is really significant, is that the governor proposes that these transfers are one time only. They don't carry forward, they don't do anything to solve the ongoing budget shortfall, which I think we know as of a couple hours ago, is continuing on into the out years. We are almost certain to see additional $1 billion shortfalls. So in our view, these raids on statutorily dedicated funds, they raise constitutional concerns, they represent a breach of faith, and they don't do anything to solve any long-term problems. So we would really urge you to the committee to take a very hard look at them. As Steve Morris also mentioned, we are also concerned about the overall impact of the governor's general fund cuts, particularly as we move forward and look forward to the next biennium. Just to put this into context, using our analysis of the five primary conservation agencies, in 2002 and 2003, the general funds for those five primary conservation agencies was $411 million combined. By the beginning of the current biennium, before the cuts were made, but as using the forecast base amount for the current biennium, those agencies were at $341 million. Under the governor's proposed budget, it's shrunk to $312 million, about almost $100 million loss in general funds. So that's just the context.
What was that time period again?
From 2002 to 2003, that biennium, to the end, to the governor's proposals for the current biennium. Now, looking forward, if the governor's budget were enacted as it's proposed, including his cuts or his proposals to ratify the unallotments of this biennium, those same budgets would shrink down to $305 million. And that, and our concern there is that given the overall budget pictures as we look into the out years, we would shrink substantially under 1% of total state general fund spending. We drop down to 0.86% of general fund spending. So although we're keenly aware of the enormous budget pressures that don't seem to be going away, and we appreciate the work of the legislature in trying to solve these very serious problems, we urge you to look for ways to avoid this kind of erosion of conservation funds. And we really appreciate the opportunity to share our observations. With that, there's a particular concern we have with the governor's proposed use of clean water funds. And so I'm going to turn it over to Paul Austin from MCEA to talk about that.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Austin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Austin. I'm with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And I just would like to talk about one of the governor's proposals that we think is a warning marker for how you could deteriorate this funding over time. Specifically, in the governor's supplemental budget, he proposes a $2 million annual use of the Clean Water Fund for the Metropolitan Council's Inflow and Infiltration Program, the I&I program. And we've got a problem with that on two fronts, at least. First of all, the I&I program is a very old program. It has had funding from other sources in the past. So to fund it solely out of the Clean Water Fund as though it's a startup doesn't make sense. It's not a new program. Obviously, it's a good idea to keep water from flowing into sewer systems for a number of reasons, but it is not new. The second has to do with the purpose of the Clean Water Fund and whether or not the I&I program meets that purpose. The Clean Water Fund was established to clean up lakes and rivers and streams. The I&I program has at least two facets to its endpoint goal. For those of you who are familiar with the program, I may be repeating this, but communities are billed by the Met Council for the volume of wastewater they send to the main treatment plants. The communities then turn around and bill their citizens based on that volume of billing. One of the main reasons sewer systems worry about the flow of rainwater or groundwater from outside the sewer system into the sewer system is because it artificially inflates the volumes of wastewater that are in that system. So if you're worried about the billing on the volume of water that you're running out of your community, you don't want your actual wastewater to be added to by this inflow of other sources of water. It increases the amount of money you end up paying. So I&I on its base level tends to be a cost control issue. And that's where you most often see it discussed and referred to, is when you're talking about community billing and managing the sewer system. Secondarily, you will hear people talk about I&I affecting the capacity of the wastewater treatment plants. If you have water being added to the system, at some point you do overrun your treatment plant capacity. I would submit that that is still not a direct connection to the Clean Water Fund, because you're dealing with a sewer system capacity issue that, A, has been addressed for a while, and, B, ironically, doesn't apply when the water is at its most vulnerable. Wastewater standards are developed for 99% of the standards are developed to apply when you're in a drought condition. The drought of 88 was the last time we saw this massive drought that really dropped the water levels in the rivers. When you're in that kind of a scenario, inflow and infiltration into a sewer system isn't an issue. You don't have the heavy rains. You don't have the basement sump pumps pumping water into the system. So the water quality target that the system is built to address in a drought scenario isn't one that applies when you're trying to address I&I. So when I sit and look at this from our perch as people who watch water quality issues, I have a real hard time making a direct connection between water quality in the river under its most stressed conditions, which is what the system is built to address, and inflow and infiltration. So we have concerns both in terms of substituting, not supplementing, a traditional source of funding as the way the governor presents it, and then just a match with the purposes. We can make a long chain match, but it doesn't seem to be as tight a match as we'd like to see for the actual purposes of the Clean Water Fund itself. So with that, we'll stand for questions.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, or Ms. Appledorn, when you're talking about the statutorily dedicated funds, and you're going to, I assume if there's a 5% reduction in the budget, that you would you be acceptance of a 5% reduction in those statutory funds, or would you like to see just no reduction at all?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, we are not thinking, I think when we think of proportionate reductions, we think that it's okay if the size of a fund grows and shrinks. We think it's appropriate, like with the general fund, that conservation funding might grow or shrink as the overall size of that fund changes. But the problem with the raids on the statutorily dedicated funds is that the size of those funds isn't growing or shrinking. We're just cutting programs from those funds to put it somewhere else. So actually, Senator Fredrickson, I think our position would be that we should not have any raids on dedicated funds, because it's not that the size of the fund is changing, like with the general fund.
And, Madam Chair, I would just underscore that again. That's the language that we have in the letter that we handed out, Senator Fredrickson, is that these funds should just not be raided and used for other purposes. We shouldn't take our voters' money and use it to balance the general fund. So we'd say no raids.
Well, the issue, though, for us is, I mean, if you want us to protect our percentage of general fund, the best way to do that would be to take the statutory or the other funds. And if we don't take any of the dedicated funds, which I would prefer not to do, then that means we have to hit the general fund more, and that will affect our overall percentage of general fund in the budget. So just, I mean, those are competing principles that you're asking us to follow. So just realize that's hard.
And Madam Chair, we understand that. And all we're saying is that, you know, the problem is in the general fund. And, you know, when we passed the amendment, all of us together collectively passed the amendment last year, we had 1.1% of the general fund. We're saying, whatever you do, just don't take it below 1%. There'll be a little give and take. And, you know, so that's our basic request. And we understand you have targets that may make it more difficult. We also understand there's new money on the table. Not to say it's all going to come here, but those are the, you know, we understand it's all a balance and a trade-off, but we think the principles are pretty sound and pretty simple.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a similar question, I guess, as what you and Senator Fredrickson were voicing. And to the point of, as we try to wrestle with the budget, not only for this part of the budget, but the entire budget, and if your request is that we not take any of the general fund monies or to preserve the funding the way it is, do you have recommendations of where we ought to take the money from, if not from there? is, I mean, if we are going to solve the budget and you say, let's preserve the funding for these things intact, then we're going to have to find additional cuts in other places. Is there another priority that you think we ought to look at to take them from if it's a matter of setting priorities of where we're going to cut? Do you have any advice for us on where we should look?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I'd take a crack at that, and others may too, but just a couple of points. We're not seeing no reductions in this area. We're saying on the general fund side, which is where the budget issue is, that we should shrink and grow, as Ms. Appledorn said, as the general fund grows. Just keep our proportion. We expect when we'll go down some as the budget shrinks, as it's shrinking now, and we should take a proportional reduction, as we did last year, and we did not raise objections with that. And when it grows in the next biennium, if it does, we expect we would grow, just to keep that proportionality. We think that's a reasonable way to do it. We don't know of a better way to measure how we, you know, make sure this money is supplementing and not substituting. In terms of what other priorities, I'm sure individually we'd all have other priorities, but you know, I don't think that's really our responsibility to figure out what those other priorities are. We just want to be real clear on what we think is important in this area.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Morris, the budget forecast today made our job a little easier between now and end of May, but it made it more difficult a year from now sitting at this table. So understanding that, what's your position as it relates to reducing general fund and backfilling with new fees? Can we accumulate those, replace some general fund with fees to try in aggregate maintain the same percentage? I mean, because I think that's the kind of decisions that are going to be around here a year from now, is if we're still short in general fund, is there a way to free up some general fund money by some new fees, and could those be replace some general fund and still in aggregate keep you at the same percentage?
Well, Madam Chair, others may want to comment. We haven't really looked at that question carefully. I mean, I think that that's a reasonable question, Senator Bach, and we'd be happy to kind of give it some thought and, you know, work with our various groups and come up with some positions. I think the key would be, you know, as long as the fees aren't somehow raiding the other funds, and I don't think that's what you're suggesting. You know, I wouldn't say that's off the table. They're, you know, Senator Bach may be doing a carbon fee, and, you know, that might be a good way to replace some of this.
Madam Chair, I won't be here long enough to ever support a carbon tax. But I do think looking at the depth of the problem this time next year, this is not going to get solved with just some new general fund revenue. The problem's too big. So, I mean, I really think realistically we got to look at if the next governor is going to generate as much general fund revenue as you can generate without negatively impacting the economy, is there another way to get some additional money that and still live within the spirit of maintaining the 1% number by aggregating maybe some fees? I just think this, I mean, the job for next year got a lot tougher today.
And Madam Chair, Senator Bach, we'd be happy to explore some of those possibilities, because I think your intent is right to maintain the integrity, to keep the faith, but we understand the challenges Senator Anderson was just saying is tough. It's a tough hill to climb.
Well, and I think it's fair to say that when you look at the other funds that we fund with most of our fees, that, you know, some of those you could fund in the general fund if you chose to, but there's good reasons to keep them separated, I think. The environmental fund, I think maybe you helped create that, Senator Morse. So I think it's fair for you all to look at some of those sources of funding when you look at how we're doing as a percent of the state budget. I don't know that it's really fair to just look at general fund, given how we've set things up. Any comments on that? Or?
Well, Madam Chair, we consider those dedicated funds set aside for those specific purposes. And when they were set aside, for example, going back to the SCORE tax that, you know, was in my first term here when that was set up, you know, it got chewed away at, eaten at a little bit and got, you know, kind of like the environmental trust fund, it got depleted and then it got protected because it was slowly eaten away at. And as I, you know, I have to go back and look at the history of the Environmental Fund. I certainly was involved in that. But there were always trade-offs as those funds were put together. But they were always put together with the express and dedicated intent to use that money for those environmental conservation programs. And so, you know, we just really don't think we can start the process of saying, well, you know, for some reason this is one to support general fund. That's a hard stretch for us.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you. And I think having those separated out gives them one degree of protection from this very purpose that we're talking about, to balance the general budget. And I don't think that's appropriate. But I think when we're talking about the state's commitment to environmental and natural resource and conservation programs, we're not looking at the whole pie if we ignore some of those funds as well. And so it's important to consider if some of those funds are growing. You know, we raised some fees last year to try to cover the cost of permitting. We could have put those in the general fund, but we thought it made sense to keep those in a separate fund. That doesn't mean you shouldn't count them as part of our state's commitment, because you're kind of looking to give us a hard time for reducing our general fund when maybe we are increasing our commitment in some other areas. So I just want to make sure we're talking about the whole picture. I mean, I'm not disagreeing that it's important to look at how we're doing as a portion of the state's budget, but maybe just focusing on general fund doesn't tell the whole story. All right, any other comments or questions? Thank you. Very detailed and helpful testimony. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. All right, next I've got Ray Bone. Is he here? Yeah, great. And Ron Harnack, I don't know if you guys are want to come up together. Okay, great. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Ray Bone. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, and Ron Harnack, who's here representing the Red River Watershed Management Board. We have just a couple of small issues we'd like to chat with you about, dealing with drainage and also some stream gauges. Bowser and the governor has recommended to cut a couple of small drainage programs, and we would like to see that not happen. We think they're a high priority for the state. We had, back in 2009, $500,000 was recommended, actually put in the budget, for drainage records modernization, which is a cost-share program with drainage authorities across the state. And with that $500,000, 44 drainage authorities actually applied for those funds, and 22 were funded either fully or partially. So clearly there's a need, and many of the records we're talking about go back to the early 1900s, and literally you're almost afraid to open up some of the paper because you don't know if it's going to hold together or not. So we believe it's important to get those records modernized, getting electronically digitized. We use them, often when we're dealing with drainage issues and ditch issues, and we would like to make them more accessible to the public. And we believe by doing that, that's one of the outcomes that will happen. And I also think that that's important as we start moving more and more down the TMDL process, and as drainage ditches come into play in those locales, I think having those records could be extremely important and will be important as well. So we this last biennium, that $500,000 in the 1 year actually is reduced to $100,000 in both fiscal years, 2010 and 2011. And what's being recommended is you cut the 2011. And our concern is it isn't a lot of money, frankly, if you cut that, then we lose the impetus, we lose the program, and it probably may never come back. And then, it is a good catalyst for our watershed districts and for the counties or drainage authorities to look at the modernization process and to get that done. And we think it's a high priority for the state and should remain in there in some form. So, and with that, I'd like to ask Ron to comment on a couple of issues.
All right, welcome, Mr. Harnack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ron Harnack with the Red River Watershed Management Board. I'd just like to echo Ray's concerns. You know, drainage has been a hot topic around the legislature for a number of years, and it doesn't seem to be waning any. Yet, as we look at this kind of a program that's going to put our drainage records in shape so that they're public, they're electronic, and will be continually updated, seems to be taking a step backward, or maybe suggesting that drainage isn't as big an issue as people may think it was. but I don't believe that that's the case. The second aspect is the legislature was very helpful in getting the drainage work group going. It's a strong interdisciplinary group that has brought forward some, I think, very worthwhile drainage legislation to help improve the drainage process, to incorporate water quality, water quantity issues much more easily into the system. Being able to get that information out to drainage authorities and educate them and inform them on how to use it is pretty important. And one of the things that's being reduced out of this budget is updating the drainage manual for local authorities that can be used in training sessions as we move forward. Both of these drainage issues are really one-time funding issues. And it seems like we are not going to be committed to carrying this out in the general fund. And if that's not the case, I think we need to give serious consideration to LCCMR or even the Clean Water Fund as one-time allocations to get these things completed and get them in place. Drainage isn't going to go away. We hear it every day up in the Red River Valley that drainage is the culprit for flooding and what have you. But we've got to stay on top of the issues, keep people informed, and work together to try to find answers to these issues. Having this information is valuable. The second issue I'd like to speak to, Madam Chair, is with regard to the Division of Waters reductions in stream gauging. They are proposing a $50,000 reduction in their base funding to stream gauging throughout the state. It's a cooperative issue with the USGS. There are four gauges that are in the Red River Valley. And at a time when the legislature has directed the funding of a basin-wide comprehensive flood damage reduction strategy, when climate conditions are changing, that's changing the hydrology of our watersheds, when land uses are continuing to change, we need sound information to do a better job of calibrating our models so we know how to manage our water better, both for quantity and quality. Therefore, we think it's really a step backwards to look at reducing our efforts in these arenas today. The watershed districts attempt to cooperate in these efforts. Having these reductions come at this point in time without the ability to work with the GS and work with the DNR to figure out ways and means to maybe find alternative ways to deal with these in the short run has really not been in place to be able to get at. And, you know, we've got just two examples. One gauge in Roseau is key to the predictions for Roseau's flood response. We've got another one at Twin Valley that's key to Norman County and the city of Ada's flood response. National Weather Service uses both of these gauges. The city of Roseau puts this gauge up on their board in their city hall to track the flood stage increases as we go back and forth. We recognize that budget cuts need to come somewhere. We're looking for time to be able to work with the agencies to find better ways to continue these so that we don't lose them from our system. You take the money out of the state side of it and you say, oh, watershed districts, you pick it up. The watershed district's money comes from the same kind of places your money comes from. And we have caps on how much we can levy. We'd love to come back and increase our base levy from $250,000 to $500,000 a year, but I'm sure you're not just going to give that a rubber stamp. So we're asking for some consideration in this issue that if it could be deferred, that would be great. We're looking for some opportunities to continue to work with Division of Waters to find some other alternatives. We think we may be able to find some, but we ask at least at a minimum you give them some flexibility in being able to find how to get these reductions rather than necessarily just taking it from this program. Madam Chair, that concludes my comments, and I'd stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Harnack, I can't help but ask, if there's $60 million or so in the bonding bill for flooding, could we buy a couple of gauges with some of that?
You know, Madam Chair, that question came up this morning from a representative. And, you know, to put these in place is a capital improvement. To maintain them is not.
Okay.
And that's realistically the problem. It's like with a lot of other things. We buy a lot of land. We put a lot of things in place. And then we ask, how are we going to maintain them?
No, that's a very good point, and we're facing that in a lot of different areas. So appreciate that. Any questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
And finally, I have Wayne Brandt. Is he still here?
He's here.
Want to go look for him? Oh, here he is. Welcome to the committee.
Do we have a handout?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Wayne Brandt. I'm Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries and the Minnesota Timber Producers Association. The members of Minnesota Forest Industries are manufacturers of pulp, paper, engineered wood products, lumber, and renewable energy from forest sources, which is an expansion since the last time I was in front of this committee of our membership and scope of activities. Members of Minnesota Timber Producers Association are loggers, truckers, small sawmills, and allied businesses. I don't envy you your task with this budget and the things that you're going to have to go through once again in arriving at a balanced budget. I think everybody's always wanted to be on the finance committees heretofore. I'm not sure that this is the most fun place to serve in this environment, but it is what it is. Nature of my testimony is going to be apparently very narrow, just on some financial numbers relating to the DNR's timber sale program. I'm not going to be speaking holistically about forest management. Well, we've talked about that before, so my remarks will be narrower than they are, but I don't want anyone to think that it diminishes our commitment to sound forest management. The DNR's timber program, timber sales program, supports a substantial number of jobs here in our state. The numbers you have on the handout, DNR's percentage of wood we utilize to the total that we utilize, that's how we derive the numbers. So wood harvested on DNR-managed land supports 12,375 private sector jobs, the payroll of about $600 million, stated. This is from those jobs, total of $42.3 million. The state, its net revenues of about $20.19.7 million from those timber sales. Now, you'll notice the footnote on the bottom, the way we arrive at the 19.7 million as we allocate timber sale cruising, administration sale layout, scaling, supervision, site prep, planting, and timber stand improvement. We don't allocate all the costs of the Division of Forestry to the timber program because with or without a timber program, you're going to have costs of that land. The economic impact of the wood harvested on DNR-managed lands is about $812 a cord. The wages supported out in the private sector are about $76 a cord. We're not arguing that the DNR not be cut. We understand you have to make cuts. Understand that there will be cuts in the DNR, cuts in the Division of Forestry. We would just respectfully request and encourage you to try and keep those cuts away from areas that support substantial private sector activity. I guess we're close to, but not quite there, of the old adage, replacing taxes with cuts. So don't cut you, don't cut me, cut the guy behind the tree. We'd like to you to think about the guy behind the tree that cuts it down when you're making these cuts. So that's my pitch on that. The second thing, and I don't know if Dr. Zemeta is going to be speaking on the Forest Resource Council. I'm also a member of the Forest Resources Council. you know, it's all general fund. We think the council still provides very substantial value in implementing the Sustainable Forest Resources Act. It is not simply the council, the 17 members, but it is the programs attendant to that that provide value and we believe provide savings in the planning process, in implementing sound practices on the ground, avoiding litigation and other areas of additional costs, as well as providing a framework for the certification of state forest lands through the use of the forest management guidelines. I would also note that the Forest Resources Council, if we go back to, I believe, 04, had a budget of about $1.2 million with the governor's recommendation. It's down to about $700,000. The council has been innovative in seeking private sector funds, obtaining them from foundations and other places to effectively leverage the general fund dollars that are there to implement the Sustainable Forest Resources Act. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brandt. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brandt, it's a bit of a digression, but what are you seeing in the next 12 to 24 months in terms of return to normal as far as the economy and the timber industry?
Grant.
Madam Chair, Senator Saxhog, a thumbnail overview of where things are at. The paper markets, while not robust, have been okay the last several years. Frankly, they've held up a little better than I think we would have thought with the depths of the recession that we've had. Some of that has been exchange rates that have made foreign imports more expensive. Some of it has been the capital investment through the years in these mills here in Minnesota. They are still quite efficient on an international scale. So the paper markets have held up pretty well. Obviously, the rest of the business in terms of engineered wood and lumber is driven essentially by the housing market. I think we saw some numbers in the morning paper of, I don't know, 30, 40, 50%, 40% increase, something like that, in housing starts in the Twin Cities from February of 09 to February of 10. That's certainly good news, but February of 10 is still one-third of what February of 05 was. So on the building side, you know, until the national economy recovers, until the credit markets get worked through at the national level, you know, we see, you know, we don't see it getting any worse, but any improvement is slight, and we think will be slow. I'm not sure that we will see the go-go days in housing of the earlier part of 7-8 years ago, 6-7 years ago, with 2 million to 2.3 million housing starts. Last year nationally, we were at about 590,000 housing starts, so about a third to a quarter of the peak. I don't see us getting back to 2.3 million. That was an overheated market with a whole host of contributing factors. So paper has been stable, has held up very well, and you know, some slight improvement in building, but we don't see it getting any worse right now, unless we go into severe double dip recession.
I guess that's good news, kind of.
So. Well, it's kind of, I try to be a little bit optimistic,
yeah,
Madam Chair.
Sure. That's good. Yeah, you know, got to take what we can get for good news, Senator Saxon.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Brandt. What about, for instance, the biomass market? Are you seeing that as something that might take up the slack that we lost from the building?
Madam Chair, Senator Saxhog, as I mentioned in my opening, you know, we now have Minnesota Power as a member of Minnesota Forest Industries. They're probably the fourth or fifth largest wood using industry in the state. Our members also convert substantial amounts of wood fiber into energy, both electricity as well as process heat and steam. I think that we will see the further development of biomass usage, both for renewable electric power and for other fuel sources. We certainly hope broadly that we will find that development in our state at the higher value-added areas. You know, that would certainly be our hope and our desire. We think that there's, while certainly not unlimited wood out there, and the DNR has done a good job of working with the university and quantifying amounts of fiber that are out there. We think that there is a substantial amount of wood that can support renewable energy production. And I think it also provides an opportunity to the DNR, to private landowners, to the counties, to get their forest plans implemented and to get our forests into a healthier condition. When the industry, when we were running wide open back in 05, I mean, we bought anything anybody put on the market. Didn't matter if it was 6-8 cords to the acre of punky wood, we were buying it and running it through the mills because the market was so overheated. We can't afford to process some of that material into paper, the chemical costs, the cleaning costs for that wood, the environmental costs for that wood are very significant, the cost of harvesting it for the realization isn't there, but it is a good material for converting into energy in the various forms. So, we're hopeful that there'll be an orderly development. There's been a lot of schemers and dreamers that have been drifting through the Northwoods with renewable energy projects, and then there's been a lot of legitimate businesses that are carefully looking at it, utilizing the working with PCA, with DNR, with the university to understand their products, their processes, and what's available out there. And we look forward to the orderly development of that.
Thank you.
Do you see some potential for carbon credits, carbon sequestration, et cetera?
Madam Chair, we believe that that has a significant potential as those markets develop, particularly to help private landowners with managing, hiring foresters to do sound practices and sound management. And frankly, it's also potentially a very large revenue source for the state of Minnesota and for the counties. It remains to see how those markets are going to develop, how those protocols develop. California's system, where they count all of the carbon in a tree as being released to the atmosphere the day it's harvested, is clearly unrealistic. I mean, this table is 50% carbon. It's been here a while. It's going to be here quite a while more. So we think, there's significant, potential there for both the public sector and the private sector. We look forward to that.
Good. All right. Well, thank you very much for your comments today.
Madam
Chair.
Appreciate
it. Let's ask if anyone else, Mr. Zumeta, did you want to say anything? Okay. Anyone else? Pardon me?
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Appreciate that. Anyone else who would like to be heard today in terms of public testimony on the budget? All right. Thank you all very much. And next, let's move on to the Renewable Development Fund and get an update. First, Mr. Alders from Excel. Welcome to the committee. Thanks.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senators. Jim Alders from Xcel Energy, Director of Regulatory Administration. I understand my task today to be to give you an overview of funding to the Renewable Development Fund that was established back in 1994 and started operating in 1999. What's being passed out in front of you is a brief little spreadsheet or table laying out for you funding to the Renewable Development Fund this year and over the next 3 or 4 years. The Renewable Development Fund was established in 1994 as part of the debate about nuclear power. Xcel Energy is obligated to set aside $16 million each year that spent fuel is stored at Prairie Island, and Xcel Energy is obligated to set aside $350,000 each year that a cask is stored at our Monticello nuclear power plant. We currently have 10 spent fuel storage containers at Monticello, and so we are setting aside $3.5 million a year for spent fuel stored at Monticello. And that is a total of $19.5 million that you see there that's labeled ratepayer deposits. We anticipate that we will be adding additional storage containers at Monticello out in the 2012 or 13 time frame, and so that's why that 19.5 increases to 23 million in that later year. Typically, in the past, we have gone through a process which we call cycles of grantsmanship, where we have invited people interested in developing renewables or doing research in the area of renewables to give us proposals. We then evaluate those proposals and select on the order of 15 or 20 proposals to award grants to out of the Renewable Development Fund. We've gone through that process three times. We've made awards of $66 million. We anticipate that we will be going through the next cycle of grantsmanship here in the next year, this coming fall. And that's what's identified in this table as the $15 million for Cycle 4. We've not made commitments to that process yet, but if indeed it does proceed, we estimate that we will be making commitments to $15 million of the fund to support various renewable proposals and grants coming out of that cycle of the program. If I might skip a row, we have a row labeled University of Minnesota Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment. The legislature established a $5 million grant to that University of Minnesota research program over the next two bienniums, and that's what you see with the $5 million in that role for each year. REPI, Renewable Energy Production Incentives, is another program that was identified as one to use funds coming out of the Renewable Energy or the Renewable Development Fund. This is a production incentive program for small renewables, small wind power projects, small biogas projects, and if there is funds remaining, small hydro projects. This program is administered by the Office of Energy Security and the Department of Commerce, and we transfer funds to that program as they use them to provide production incentives. And then lastly is our administration. Each of our grant contracts or grant awards is followed up with a contract that lays out performance standards for the grantee. We administer and oversee the program, make sure that the funds are being used for the purposes that were identified, documenting milestones achieved, and generally administrating the program so that those funds go out to each of the grant award winners each year. And as you can see, when we go through a cycle of the funding program, our administrative costs go up because we ask outside consultants to help us evaluate the proposals we receive. All of the proposals that we select, we then in turn go to our Public Utility Commission for oversight to get their approval to make sure that they believe we're responsibly managing ratepayer funds in our awards to those that receive those grants. Madam Chair, that's a very high-level overview of where we are with the program and what we anticipate the funding will look like over the next several years. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Alders. Can you tell us when the last grant round was that you did and how much money that was for?
Yeah. Madam Chair, cycle three of our grant program was generally in 2007. It selected 22 projects to award grants to totaling $27.5 million.
And I'm wondering, can you sort of summarize the outcomes that you've measured these against? What are we achieving with these funds?
Madam Chair, we've made grants on the order of $66.6 million. We've leveraged something on the order of $108 million from others and from the private sector. By doing that, we've produced something like 4,000 megawatt hours of renewable energy. From photovoltaics, something like 60,000 megawatt hours from wind projects. There's been on the order of 25 technical papers that have been produced through research and development projects in academia to address barriers to further development of wind power beyond what's currently commercially available. I thought I had a greenhouse gas reduction statistic, but I can't find it at the moment.
If you can,
but we have
that.
Reduced greenhouse gas emissions as well.
Great. What on the grants to the proposed coal plant on the Iron Range, I guess that doesn't show up here because they just received their last payment, I'm presuming. That grant is done. Do you have any outcomes from that? Have any jobs been created with that money that you're aware of?
Madam Chair, we are about to make the last payment within a month or so. We assumed that payment had already been made when we prepared this graph, so it is not reflected in the table in front of you, but indeed we are making that last payment. And indeed, I don't know any of the details of their project and the extent to which jobs have been created.
Maybe, I guess, we're hoping to bring them in to tell us what, if any, outcomes they've achieved with that $10 million that we've given them. So far, I know of some lobbyists who have been hired. I hope they've got more to report than that. Great. Do you have any opinion about the governor's proposal in the budget to take funds from some of these assessed programs, some from the Renewable Development Program and some from other assessments on Excel, to balance the budget?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I'm not familiar with any of those proposals. I haven't been involved in that discussion to date. As a general principle, the Renewable Development Fund was established by the legislature, and you're certainly free to repurpose it if you think that's good public policy. I think my only observation is it's Xcel Energy's customers and ratepayers that are providing funds, and so we feel that it's very important for the benefits to flow back to our customers as well.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry, Senator Hahn had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Alders, you quoted a couple times $66.6 million. Is that the total ratepayer deposit that has been made through this program since 1994 when the program started?
Madam Chair, Senator, the funds started accumulating funds in 1999. And I believe that's the case, yes, that it's 66.6 plus the 3 million balance you see at the beginning of the chart.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Alders, you've mentioned a number of projects that have resulted in the generation of some number of megawatt hours. The question I'm trying to understand is, what have ratepayers gained from spending the $67 million? Have their rates been reduced? Have the costs of powering electricity, their home or business, have they gone down? Maybe what has been the cost per megawatt hour generated, given it took $66.6 million to generate that? Have you got that kind of analysis?
Madam Chair, Senator, I should make two points. we've made grants of 66.6, but a lot of the funds have gone to those other purposes in the lower lines of that graph. And so overall customer contributions to the fund is something higher than $66 million, and I can get you the total number, but I don't have it off the top of my head. To your second question, I think the Renewable Development Fund's purpose has generally been to try and find ways to advance renewable energy in the state. And so, no, it has not led to a reduction in cost of energy to our customers, but it has expanded the inventory of electric generation coming from renewable resources that might be available to our customers in the future. It's helped commercialize some of those resources. I think the philosophy when it was originally established was, can we target some amount of funds to help expand or advance renewable energy rather than try and reduce its cost only?
Senator Rummel.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. And so to that point, has there been cost avoidance because of the Renewable Development Fund? Have you saved ratepayers from increases, for example, of building new plants or whatever?
Mr. Alders?
Madam Chair, Senator, I can't point to a specific example of something like that. I think it's a relatively small amount of the renewable energy that we purchase or fund is funded by this particular program. I think in large part the 12% or 13% of the energy we serve our customers with that comes from renewables is a cost-effective resource when compared to other alternatives, and we are developing it in part to meet the state's renewable energy standards. And so there's a much bigger renewable energy program than just the Renewable Energy Fund that is driving the addition of renewables to the system.
And Senator Rummel, I think that's a really great question. And obviously some of the spending has been driven by the legislature and some granted by the board. And it would be useful to evaluate all of that. The legislative auditor is doing an audit of the Renewable Development Fund, and I talked with them probably last summer. They didn't have time to get to it yet, so it was sort of on their next round of audits, and they're probably still open to ideas for forming the study, because I think this would be a good time to delve into that. And so I would encourage you to talk to Jim Nobles about that question. So
Madam
it'll be
Chair,
useful information.
Excuse
Mr.
me.
Alders, go ahead.
Just been passed a note that $163 million has gone into the Renewable Energy Fund since 1999.
Total. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. If there's no other questions, thank you for being here. We appreciate it. And then Mr. DeFebri. So the long sheet is from the Office of Energy Security members. Did you see this email yet? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here again. I should note that it did take me nearly 45 minutes to find a parking space. You're very popular today.
This place, it's been really busy all week. So, yesterday too.
Madam Chair, how would you like to proceed with these numbers?
Whatever you think is the simplest way to explain them, and sort of let us know what balances exist this year, next year, and into future years, when obligations will be, what obligations are current and which ones are phasing out. Just help us read this spreadsheet.
Certainly, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremy DeFebri from the Office of Energy Security. We might as well start at the top and
give some explanation of the categories, the various columns that we've provided numbers in. We've attempted under the activities to mirror what was on the budget information sheet for the governor's supplemental budget recommendation in order so that these tracked along with that. The funding is that which is either was is currently allocated to that activity. Some of these were not the original allocation. There have been subsequent reappropriations of some funds, but this is where we stand today in the funding column for what has been the total allocated to those. The next column is fairly self-explanatory, that those are dollars actually spent and out the door. That leaves us with a balance between the funding and the expended. The governor's supplemental recommendation is a further reduction to that balance. And then the final column is what we have actual obligations within the system against that balance. And there are probably on some of those lines there are some explanations for that. So if you want to start simply with the first line, the RDF biogas, we do have 2 years of $500,000 a year that was allocated to that. We ran that as one grant. We have an outstanding obligation for one of those grants, but we also do have one of the one that is obligated is stalled on trying to find financing, and we have another grantee that was identified that is having difficulty finding financing and so has not wanted to execute a grant agreement at this time. So there are some funds in that account that have yet to be obligated. The next line, which is solar electric projects, is an earlier, I believe, a 2007 or a 2008 allocation of funds to solar rebates. Most of those funds are expended. We have a small balance of $16,000. The governor's recommendation is to reduce that by $4,000. We have reservations for rebates that would fully utilize all of the funds in that account. The next is CERTS, the Clean Energy Resource Teams. That was continuation. That is a $625,000 a year has been appropriated. There's actually a second line down, two-thirds of the way down the page, that is current year or current biennium CERTS allocation. So this first one is previous biennium and shows some carry forward from that is at this point. Not a committed fund. Automotive projects are largely a number of grants to Mankato State, Bemidji, University of Minnesota, and MnDOT for various research and development projects related to both battery storage, plug-in hybrids, and the like. Hydrogen Roadmap is essentially, it was an appropriation for developing a process for how to proceed with hydrogen development in the state. And then after that was done, we issued an RFP, request for proposals for projects based on the outline of that roadmap. We currently have approximately $600,000 balance there. We do have grant applications identified as potential grantees, but do not have grants in place for any of those projects.
That would be for the full amount of the balance?
That would be for the full amount, the $607,000, yes. On the next line, renewable energy grants, those again, on the far right, if I have identified a number of grantees that are currently, we have obligations in place to them, projects that are in process. Those obligations are lower than the actual balance that is available in that fund. And I should note that is the one number that I this was rather short notice. I do want to check that in going over these numbers, that did look a little larger than I thought it should be. So I would very much like to have a chance to go back and check that one this afternoon. The RDF, the Green Jobs Task Force, and is again an account that the Green Jobs Task Force spent significantly less than was allocated to it under appropriations. Those funds have carried forward to other purposes, but are yet unobligated. The Midwest Governors Association is the impacts study that is underway. That is after we show the governor's supplemental, we do show a slight greater obligation than we would have funds available, a couple of thousand dollars there. The UMD heat flow maps was authorized in 2009. We currently have a contract in place for $250,000, and that is another one that I think I need to go back because I believe there's $50,000 in next fiscal year that may be obligated also. So I need to see whether that is on the obligated line should be $300,000. CERT's current is there again. There is in this biennium $625,000 allocated to CERT's. They currently have under contract the first year, and so in what's showing in the balance that is unobligated is largely the second year, the $625,000. So if you reduce the revised balance by that amount, that would be what if you were to intending to provide that $625,000 in the second year, that would be an intended obligation. Let's put it that way. It's not obligated in the system, so it doesn't book that way. It is we can't contract with we do not contract with them for the multi-year activity. We contract with them on an annual basis. Particularly currently, we are reassessing on CERTS how that program is structured and what activities are delivered by which entity. There are multiple entities that are doing that, and we've gone through a facilitated planning process with them on how best to do that. So that's one of the reasons why we have been limiting the contracts to an annual, because we needed to go through that process. Solar rebates are, again, a 2009 appropriation of funds for solar. I believe this one was not just electric, but could include solar water. While that shows a balance that is 100% of the appropriation, we do have reservations against most of that balance. The IREDI grant was to Mankato State for the International Renewable Energy Technology Initiative, and that currently we do have a contract in place with them. There have been no expenditures on that, or there have been no invoices on that. I would presume that we would likely be seeing invoicing beginning relatively soon. The Solar CERTS Certification Lab for University of Minnesota, again, is an activity that we have a contract in place there. It's relatively recent, so that we do not have any invoicing that's occurred on that, but we do have that obligation that shows in the right column. And then the Green Jobs line is a small grant to Minnesota Environmental Initiative that is currently obligated, but no expenditures have been made against it.
All right, thank you. That's helpful. Do you have any questions? Okay, are there questions? All right, that's very helpful. I appreciate the update. I just have a question about appliances.
Madam Chair,
is that your turf?
Madam Chair, I'm shocked that you would bring that up.
It is.
It is not my turf. Mr. Glahn may be able to answer some limited questions. I may be able to answer some of these.
And I understand the money's all gone in about 24 hours or less. Is that true? Mr. Glahn, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sanders, Bill Glahn, Deputy Director of Commerce, Director of the Minnesota Office of Energy Security. Yes, to answer your question, the money all gone in approximately 25 hours.
Well, that's amazing. I remember complaining for a number of years that rebates weren't enough to affect buying behavior for appliances, but I think that three-digit number got people's attention. I think that probably made the difference. We've never seen $100 rebates before. That's my guess, anyway.
Madam Chair, Senators, I think you're right. It was a delicate balance of trying to set the rebate level for each appliance at a number high enough to induce folks to go out and start shopping for it and make a commitment to purchase, but also low enough that we could spread the rebates as widely as possible. And so I think we probably, it's fair to say, took a little different approach than we have in the past, trying to learn from what we were taking as lessons from other states that were out ahead of us, who had put programs out and didn't have the subscription level that we saw. So trying to get a number big enough to get people excited about it, but enough to spread it around as much as we could. And in the event it was well oversubscribed, the money was committed within 25 hours, and we closed off the waiting list after adding 10,000 names to the waiting list.
So you now have 10,000 names on the waiting list?
That's correct.
In case there's more money.
In case there's more money or the reservations that have been made, they have 30 days in which to go and claim the money. And at the end of those 30 days, if the money has not been claimed, then we would go and release that to folks on the waiting list. Or as we dig through the carnage that was yesterday, then if we discover that more than one per household or there were duplicates in the system somehow, then we would move those on to the next folks on the waiting list.
So this was how many million dollars and how many rebates again? Just remind us.
Madam Chair, Senators, it was $5 million approximately, give or take a few dollars, and 25,400 rebates approximately.
Jeez, that is really unbelievable in 25 hours. The complaint that I've received is from a disabled person in my district who called me and said that they don't have internet access, and what was the other access point? And they didn't have automatic redial on their very cheap phone, and so they had no way to get through the hordes. And apparently this is a person who really is in desperate need of a new appliance. And I'm wondering if you heard any other complaints. I mean, I know we heard complaints about the system crashing, but have you heard any other specific concerns like that one? That they couldn't – oh, and I guess they tried to call the phone number that was given for after hours, and it wasn't working, and they couldn't get through that number either.
Madam Chair, Senators, I have not heard that specific complaint. I've heard a number of complaints in the last 30 hours or so. But if you forward to me that person's information, I will get back to them.
Okay. That would be great. And we would be interested in hearing, I mean, if you can follow up, if you hear, I mean, on your waiting list, or if you hear of other concerns like that where I think someone had an unusual, I mean, obviously a lot of people just weren't the first ones in line. And but this type of situation I think is pretty unusual. And if you hear of more of those, we might want to try to do something to help people in that narrow category. Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to get the opinion of the witnesses or anybody else at the table here on this idea. A representative of the Glencoe Utilities and Hutchinson Utilities met with me about a month before session started, and I talked to you about this once, Senator Anderson, about they wanted to take the 1.5% that they have to use for of their gross revenue that they have to use for conservation purposes, and they wanted to be able to use half of that and donate it to a local organization that manages the heating assistance for low-income people, the LEAP program. In my area, it's a Heartland Community Action group that manages this. And on a voluntary basis, if a utility wanted to, they could donate up to one-half of this money for that purpose for a period of 2 years. And if they didn't want to, that was fine, but they still had to meet their energy conservation goals, which those two utilities already have met because of all the layoffs and depression in the business community. So I'm trying to figure out if this is a good idea, bad idea, whether the LEAP program has got enough money or not. And I talked to Mr. DeLafebe about this at one point in time. So what's your opinion on that?
Mr. DeFebre?
Sorry. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, my opinion is whatever Mr. Glahn's opinion is.
Mr. Glahn, do you have an opinion, or do you want to consult
your
staff?
Yeah. No, Madam Chair, Senator, I apologize to the Senator. You did bring this to the attention of our staff, and you have been near the top of my list on returning phone calls, and I apologize for not getting back to you. I think it's an interesting idea. There may be some or statutory concerns. You know, there language in the statutes about spending this money on conservation programs and utilities, including municipal utilities and co-ops, have an obligation to as you pointed, to save the 1.5%, which they might be achieving through other less fortunate ways. But there still might be statutory. But again, if you're going to have a bill, we could address those in the bill. It's about that interplay between the LIHEAP program and the intent of that and the resources available for that and the SIP program and, again, the intent and resources available for that. But it's a program or it's an idea that I hadn't heard before, and I believe it at least deserves more consideration and a more thorough answer to your question.
I don't know.
This is one quick question.
Go ahead, Senator Dill, please.
Madam Chair, members, what I think the key question here is, are there people out there, poor people, that can't pay their heating bill? Is there enough money in that program to take care of the demand? Because if there's enough money, I would forget about it. But if there's people out there that can't pay their heat bill, and I think we need to help them.
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, the short answer to your question is no. There's not enough money in that program to help all of those who are eligible. Our estimates are we are assisting through the LIHEAP program approximately one-third of the eligible population that could apply for and qualify for those monies. So there's not enough money to meet the need. We're trying very hard to distribute as quickly as we can and as widely as we can the money we do have available. So short answer to your question is there's certainly not enough resources to go around.
And Senator Dill, what I was going to say is, you know, that when we updated the SIP program, I think maybe in 2008, where we put that energy savings goal into law, instead of just having a spending goal, which has been the law for a long time, I think we also have something in law that phases out the spending program, or at least we'll review it. I'm looking to see if anybody's answering knows what that law says, that, you know, the ultimate goal really is to save a certain amount of energy. And so if utilities can be more creative about how they get that done, or if there's a recession, perhaps there might be an opportunity to use the money for something else. I guess under those circumstances, it might make sense. Mr. Glahn.
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, to answer Madam Chair's question, it was 2007 we put the 1.5% savings requirement in. We did not remove the minimum spending requirement. You did instruct us to perform a study of that, which we did perform, and in the event recommended that you at this time not remove the spending requirement.
Okay.
So I don't know if this is of any help to your utilities, Senator Dill, but we did pass last year as part of the omnibus bill some limited ability to carry funds forward and carry funds back to give utilities a little more flexibility in how they spend their money. So if there's a situation such as the one you described where there aren't those opportunities today, or there is a different set of circumstances where they're meeting their goals not through saving energy but through having unfortunately a bad economy, then they have some ability to carry that forward or do something else with it temporarily, shifting the time back and forth.
Well, and Senator Dill, you might want to introduce a bill for that, to that effect, too, in addition to, you know, under those narrow circumstances, because we perhaps should put that into law.
Yeah.
And or look at, or do an amendment to a bill. So something to think about. I know we've talked about that before as well.
Madam Chair, I do have a bill drafted. I don't know if it
okay.
includes all these things we've just been talking about. It's laying here on the table. And so did I understand you to say that there is some flexibility already in the law to allow them to do something different with this money?
Madam Chair, Senator, some limited. I'm not sure it would allow for the situation you've described.
Yeah. Well, my view on this thing is that times change, things change, economic conditions are always going up or going down, and I think at this point in the recession, it's more important to help people pay their heat bill and to help them buy another refrigerator.
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, notwithstanding the appliance rebate program, I would certainly say that circumstances are very different than they were in 2007 when we passed the Next Gen Energy Act, and we may all be well served by revisiting the issue in this current session.
Well, Mr. Glahn, I really don't hope and would expect the legislature is not interested in revisiting those energy savings goals, and there's no reason why we should, or the other goals that were set in the 2007 legislation. But I think what Senator Dill is talking about would not undermine those goals at all under the circumstances. That it's a pretty narrow idea that he's talking about.
Madam Chair, I would agree.
Very good. Any other questions? All right, thank you all. The meeting is adjourned.